Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, it would not be summer without a search for Jimmy Hoffa. On today's program, we speak with Michigan Radio's Jack Lessenberry about why at least some of us are still fascinated by the Hoffa disappearance all these years later. And then we talk about the huge economic changes to Mid-America as we speak with the author of the new book, Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. But first, speaking of the economy, that term economy is used constantly in news stories or opinion pieces about Michigan, its trials and tribulations, its budding recovery. But John Austin would like us to get thinking about what he calls the blue economy, the one based on the Great Lakes and water-related industry. John is the director of the Michigan Economic Center, and that's affiliated with the Prima Civitas Foundation. And John Austin is kind enough to join us in the studio. Good to have you with us. I always love saying Prima Civitas because it reminds me of my favorite teacher in ninth grade Latin. So it just
your Latin's terrific. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. Good to be with you, John. You coined the term blue economy. What does it actually mean?
Well, we've got our heads around the fact that there's a green economy. Mm-hmm. With lots of new technologies and clean energy, lots of retrofitting of our homes, our communities to save energy.
The environment.
And also green places with outdoors, parks, and ability to enjoy nature and even lifestyles where you choose products that are made sustainably are important decisions. There's a very analogous blue economy. Our water is a precious resource globally. Water needs to be used smarter, better, more efficiently, and clean. And water is such a magical place to find. You know, people like to – we love to live and walk and enjoy being near the water because it's a magical quality of place definer. So there's lots of new jobs in industry to be created in water treatment, water cleaning, water technology businesses. There's lots of systems from manufacturing to our homes where we want to use water much more efficiently and help save the planet. And then, you know, here in Ann Arbor, when you have an effort like River Up, which says for eons we had our backs to and used the Huron River as a dumping ground, let's provide access to it. Let's enjoy it. And all of those efforts where we sort of leverage our water as a wonderful thing to enjoy and be on and be around matter enormously to economic development and making places communities that people both want to live in because they are animating new values about sustainability and they're doing the research and problem solving like here at the University of Michigan Water Center or Grand Valley Institute's Water Center out on Muskegon. These are growth opportunities where we have wonderful assets to build on part of what's uniquely special about Michigan as the Great Lakes State.
When you think about Michigan and the other Great Lakes states, so these eight states, when you realize we're holding nearly one-fifth of the fresh water on the surface of the earth, and as you look at the history, I'd love your thoughts as to just how is it that we have some of the most horrific, awful urban wastelands and these ghost factories sitting along the shores of the lakes. We understand that, you know, the industrial Midwest suffered this decline in the latter part of the 20th century, but beyond that, what did it say about the way we thought of our Great Lakes?
Well, the story of the Great Lakes and the great industrial and agricultural development that powered us was we grew because of the water first. It was the trade route. We sent our timber floating out and to be chopped up. We sent our agricultural goods out to feed the world. And then we converted these raw materials to make things, you know, the great paper mills and car factories and steel productions along the Great Lakes. All of that was powered by water. So we used and abused our water.
When
the Cuyahoga River catches on fire, the Kalamazoo River was toxic and polluted because of the paper mills. That's when we needed to obviously clean that up. But it's really to clean up the legacies of the industrial era. And we need to appreciate now that water matters much more powerfully, not as an input or a trade route, but it matters as this magical place definer where people want to live and work and create their businesses with access to water as a enjoyment in their lives. And water matters as we try to solve the global problems of cleaning water, using it much more efficiently. Let me give you two examples.
Yeah.
You know, Traverse City, for example, in Michigan was one of the first communities that wiped away their legacy relics on their waterfront. In their case, it was the cherry canneries, and they cleaned up that waterfront, which is, you know, expensive. We have more brownfields and abandoned factories and things around our Great Lakes than any place, you know, in the country because of who we are.
Yeah.
But once you clean that up and redevelop it, keep some for walkways, keep some for marinas, allow some of it to go back to be a beautiful beach to walk along, the quality of life in a Traverse City is so powerful because of that special being on the lake ability that you see not just tourists. You know, we go up there and enjoy dropping our money when we visit Traverse City, but professionals who can choose to live and work anywhere are choosing to live in a beautiful community in large part because it's just a special piece of real estate with that kind of lifestyle to enjoy. You also have great firms that are emblematic of what powered our economy. Cascade Engineering in Grand Rapids, one of my favorites. Here's an auto parts maker, plastic injection mold auto parts.
Right.
Their CEO, I mean, a big company. That business has declined, but their CEO took them into making green products. But now they've developed an innovative freshwater filtering and cleaning device for use in the third world, very cheap. So 60% of the people in hospital in the developing world are there because of waterborne pathogens.
Hmm.
So here we're making something, converting that competency that made us great in manufacturing to make a product that's desperately needed around the world, and we're selling it, and we're also contributing to solving world's health problems. So you have young people who are going to school at the Grand Valley Water Resources Institute. They are desperate to go and intern at Cascade Engineering and work there and take their engineering and other talents because they want to contribute to solving big world problems. And if we give them that opportunity right here in Michigan, it's also sending a message about who we are. We're the forward-leaning place that's the innovator on sustainable water, sustainable energy, sustainable agriculture. These are the things that people want to work on that the world desperately needs. And we can make money and create new jobs as part of the process.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with John Austin, who's the director of the Michigan Economic Center, talking about the blue economy, the one that is powered by water. You know, and as we kind of looked at that historic progress of the way we regarded the shoreline. So you talk about what Traverse City has done, and we're certainly aware Detroit is endeavoring to do that river walk.
Right, redevelop the riverfront.
Yep. And then on the other hand, right there in southwest Detroit, you have, as we've been talking about on stateside and news reports, the monster pile of pet coke that's just dumped along by the river. Sitting there.
Right. Which is a step backward because that was us once where we didn't care about or think about how we piled up bad materials along the riverfront. Now we've had to clean it up and it's very expensive to reposition those former industrial areas. And we certainly don't need to pile up any more junk. Who wants to live and work and be in a beautiful place like Detroit working in new fields, whether it's medical or IT or otherwise, when you've got, you know, slag heaps of a modern era around? It doesn't help us move our economy. You know, just up the river from Detroit, where one of the more exciting efforts, Mark Hackle, the county executive, understanding, as we talked about it, that, you know, we need to help him and that community kind of rebrand itself if it's going to be a choice location for people to live and work. What do we know Macomb County to be? You know, Reagan Democrats and machine shops and strip
problems
malls.
With polluted beaches that have had to be closed.
So he has a blue economy initiative basically saying this is a lifestyle community where we have access to this wonderful Lake St. Clair and waterfronts, and they're purposefully both redeveloping their waterfronts so there's access and enjoyment and people and celebrating the fact that it's a special place to live and work given water and this lifestyle that you have. And that's a powerful new sort of identity for a Macomb County, and it's the same kind of reality that we have the opportunity, whether it's similar work in Muskegon. There you have one of the most beautiful harbors on Lake Michigan in the world, and, you know, dotted with the relics of the paper and other heavy industries that made us rich. How do you clean it? Because you can't develop it at all if it's not clean enough or if it's toxic.
Sure.
And the economic payoff, and we did studies with Brookings about the economic benefits of just cleaning up the Great Lakes. It's at least a $3 to $1 return. Every dollar you put into cleaning up toxic hotspots, rebuilding sewer and infrastructure systems so that the beaches aren't closed means enhanced property values, enhanced tourism, enhanced ability to be a choice location for people to live and work that pays off down the road in terms of economic benefits for the community that is cleaned up the mess and is enjoying the water. You can go up to Marquette and see the same thing on their beautiful waterfront. People, new condominiums, you know, new walkways along it. It's a place that's an exciting lifestyle place to live and work. that's all leveraged by being on this wonderful piece of real estate that includes some of the most beautiful and magical bodies of water, you know, on the planet.
Now, John, as we talk about using the Great Lakes as an economic power source, in a sense, to kind of drive us forward, could we wind up overusing the lakes or not using them wisely, as was done through the 20th century?
Well, I think the smart understanding is that you do want to keep some of it in beautiful beaches and natural areas, both because that makes it more valuable if there's parks and the beachfronts to enjoy. People not only want to live there because you have access to that, people want to come and visit, but you do want to have replace the factories and the waste dumps with, you know, marinas and public walkways, and allow some. The market wants to move in. I mean, people will pay more for an office or a vacation home or a motel or a hotel if it's on the water. And so there is opportunity. The market ultimately wants to develop that water as much as possible, but it's even more valuable if it's interlaced with scenic areas, conservation areas, protected areas, because that's what we all want to enjoy.
John Austin, who is the director of the Michigan Economic Center, which is affiliated with the Prima Civitas Foundation. He was kind enough to join us today in the studio. John, thank you so much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Still to come, two words, Jimmy Hoffa. It seems like every summer there's a new search for the labor leader who vanished nearly 40 years ago. We talk with Michigan Radio's Jack Lessenberry about why we still bother to look for him. That story's in 20 minutes, right here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Palisades nuclear power plant in southwest Michigan has restarted. That's after the plant was offline for 43 days following a leak of slightly radioactive water into Lake Michigan. That leak came from a tank used for refueling outages or in cases of emergencies. It had just been fixed last summer. In a written statement, a Palisades spokeswoman said there was no leakage from the tank now. Workers replaced most of the tank bottom and all of the nozzles because the company determined that's where the leak was coming from, although the cause of the cracked nozzle wasn't immediately clear. Nuclear regulators sent 10 special inspectors to observe the work, and they reassured the public the plant is operating safely. Palisades has been shut down several times in the past 2 years. It was upgraded from one of the worst performing plants in the country late last year. If you've grown up in Michigan or elsewhere in the Midwest, you don't need us to tell you. There's been an unbelievable shift in the lifestyle, the economy, the job expectations from, say, your parents' or grandparents' day to what we face in 2013. Here in the Great Lakes, we've gone from the arsenal of democracy during World War II to the center of manufacturing, especially of automobiles, to present day, where many of those once booming factories are empty and rotting away or falling to the wrecker's ball. Writer Edward McClelland grew up in Lansing, where once upon a time a kid could go from a high school graduation ceremony straight into a GM plant and make a great living thanks to contracts won by the UAW and go right up to retirement. Well, as we all know here in Michigan, those days are gone forever. Edward McClelland's new book digs into what happened to the industrial midsection of America, including Michigan. It's called Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. Edward McClelland joins us here in the studio. You track the history of the Midwest from boom to bust, and now as we try to rebuild and find new directions, it's a big, big story. What gave you the impetus to tackle this huge story spanning so many states?
Well, I'd say a couple things. I think it can go all the way back to after I got out of college. This was in the early 90s, and there was a recession going on then, too. And a lot of us were having trouble getting full-time jobs. And I was just fascinated by the stories that these GM veterans told me, guys who had been in for 20, 25 years, about how easy it was to find work back then. I mean, and to someone like me, a generation extra, this was just like employment porn.
Yeah.
These guys would get out and they'd put in their application 2 weeks after they graduated from high school. They were on the line. A year later, they bought a house. They had a brand new car.
Cottage
they
up
got
north.
Married. They had a cottage up north.
Yeah.
They had a boat. And so this was I was at that time looking back to this golden age of employment. And I think another thing that got me inspired to write it was I went to high school in Lansing, Sexton High School. At the time I went there, there were 2,000 students, and there was a booming auto plant right across the street, a Fisher Body plant.
Mm-hmm.
And that was torn down about 2006. And as the jobs there declined, so did the student body. And now it's about a school of about 750. It's a Class B school. And what I ultimately found out in Lansing was that that plant was replaced by a new plant in Delta Township. It was just simply obsolete. They had to truck the bodies across town, and they wanted everything in one roof. But when you talk about a historic perspective, I think now that we're in 2013, I think we can sort of put that period of the 50s and 60s and 70s in perspective, because growing up, you just thought, well, America's the richest country in the world.
That's the way it is.
Well, yeah, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
And one of the questions I ask in the book is, was this great American middle class just a moment in history? Was it something that only existed in mid-century America? And I think it's quite possible that it was, because we were really in a period where it was a unique period in history, because we were the only country that had any industrial capacity left.
After World War II.
After World War II.
Yes.
So I don't think it's ever going to be as good as it was then.
You illustrate the rise and fall of a number of states and communities. You look at Cleveland, mm-hmm. Homestead, Pennsylvania, Buffalo and Syracuse, Decatur, Illinois, a heartbreaking story there. And of course, you look at Flint and Lansing and Detroit.
Right.
We're looking at different industries, but similar life cycles?
Sure. Well, because the industries were so well connected. I mean, the steel industry's main customer was the auto industry.
Mm-hmm.
So when the auto industry went down, the steel industry went down. And I think you can look at this as also not just a unique historical moment, but a unique geographic story. I mean, the reason that we became the industrial heartland was we were sort of right in the middle between the coal of Appalachia and the iron ore of the Upper Peninsula and northern Minnesota. And we had the means, the railroads and the lakes to bring the two together.
It was,
and that's when those were the two main forms of transportation, and of course they're not anymore.
Speaking of the history, give us a history lesson. Just how good were those good times for workers and for the companies?
Okay, well, I guess I can give you a history lesson through one of the people I interviewed in the book, mm-hmm. and that was Everett Ketchum, who's a family friend of mine. He's now 98 years old, and he was a veteran of the Flint sit-down strike in 1936 and 1937. Mm-hmm. He probably is one of the last survivors, if not the last survivor, and that was just such an important moment in the history of American labor in the
yes.
middle class. And they went on strike because they had no job security and because GM was speeding up the line and the workers couldn't handle the stress. And he was the son of a farmer from northern Michigan, and his father moved on to Flint to work in the World War I munitions industry. And he was an apprentice making 50 cents an hour. And he joined the strike and they got job security. They got health benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a career, probably almost a 40-year career at General Motors. And he retired as a tool and die maker making $27 an hour. And I say that was a skilled tradesman at GM was the best job in the state, because you got paid just as well as any of the white-collar workers. And he ended up working in Lansing, so you got paid just as well as, say, the fisheries biologist down in one of the state office buildings. And
sure.
you had health care for life. And so I always kid him that, Everett, you're the reason GM is going bankrupt,
because you're
still alive and you're still using health benefits. And the more health benefits you give people, the longer they live and the more health benefits they use. You know, in his lifespan, I mean, Flint went from just a very sort of small town making carriages to an industrial powerhouse, and now this post-industrial wreck. I mean, I was just yesterday. 2 days ago, I drove by Buick City, and last time I'd seen it, it was still standing, and now it's gone. 28,000 mm-hmm. people worked there.
Where do you see things starting to go sour for auto workers and auto companies. I know you talk a lot about the Vega. You talk about the Corvair.
Well, they didn't want to make small cars in the 70s, and so they made terrible small cars. The first car I drove was a Chevette, which was a terrible car. And I remember seeing a guy in Detroit just in 2011 trying to start a Chevette, and I was not surprised that it wouldn't start. I was surprised he'd kept it running since the 1980s. And the Escort, that was a terrible car. So a lot of people of my generation drive foreign cars because they grew up on these terrible GM cars.
So was that where the worm began to turn?
Well, you can also trace it to the 1973 Arab oil embargo.
Yeah.
Gas prices went up dramatically, and that's when people became interested in small cars. And the Japanese and the Italians and the Germans, ironically the countries we had defeated in World War II and rebuilt, were the countries that were making the good small cars. So I would say that the quality of American cars, of American small cars, is just as good now as the foreign cars, but they still have that image. I see a lot of people driving the Chevy Cruze now, and which was recommended to me by an auto worker who I interviewed in the book who works at the GM Delta plant.
Mm-hmm. But there's a whole generation with a bad taste in its mouth.
Absolutely.
I'm speaking with writer Ted McClelland. His book, Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. I want to talk about the roots of Michigan's racial tensions because you spent a lot of time about that. And it seems to me, and maybe I got this wrong, that it really does, a lot of that traces back to these early factory days.
Yeah, you could say that. In the 1940s, a lot of African Americans were moving up to work in the plants. And the first race riot in Detroit was in 1943. And some people will argue that was a race riot, and the riot in 1967 was a class riot. And Attorney General Francis Biddle recommended that no more African Americans be allowed to emigrate to Detroit because of the tensions. And also, you had a lot of whites coming from the South too, and they came in and
with their inherent
They expected the social customs that they had grown up with to be continued in the North. But certainly, I think that's more particular to Detroit than, say, to Flint or to Lansing. Flint was the first city to elect an African American mayor. It was the first city to pass an open housing ordinance by popular referendum. And Lansing is the most biracial city in the United States. It is the city with the most people who claim two races and claim an African-American parent. So it was more a problem in Detroit, I think, than anywhere else.
Because of the riots during World War II and then 67?
Yes, right. Within 6 years, Detroit was a black-majority city.
Because that's what you say. First of all, you say it's a class riot. It wasn't a race riot.
Right. Well, because these people were – of course, race was an element, but these people were crammed into very congested neighborhoods, and they were overcharged for just basics of life like rent and
food.
Mattresses, food, and of course they were seeing what everybody else had, and it just blew up.
It blew up.
Right.
And as you say in your book, what was more interesting is what happened after. So that riot is the BC and the AD.
Right, and I was just interested in, other cities had riots.
Yeah.
Los Angeles had two riots. Philadelphia, Newark.
And we're still paying the price today from
exactly. that. Exactly. But Detroit never recovered. It was just worse in other cities. And I suppose you can blame things like the highway system making it easy for people to flee Detroit. And, I mean, different leadership. I talk about the difference between Coleman Young's background and the background of other African-American leaders of the era. Most of the African-American leaders of that area came out of the civil rights movement. Coleman Young was a radical labor organizer.
Yes, yes. And I want to get a little more as you track the similarities and differences between Detroit, Lansing, and Flint. And let's talk about the auto workers in Lansing and Flint. How about the factors that influence the way those cities have fared, especially during the last decade of the 2000s?
Yeah, well, I guess I come to it from a Lansing point of view, being from Lansing. But it's interesting talking to Lansing auto workers because they're almost sort of unanimous in their disdain for the militants and the work ethic of Flint auto workers. And nobody at GM is going to say it, but Flint strikes always took longer. There were more strikes, and they took longer to resolve than in other GM cities. So I really think one of the reasons that they pulled out of Flint was because the Flint auto workers never really could let go of that spirit of the sit-down strike. Mm. So they were dispersing them to plants all over the state where the dominant – the unions didn't have that dominant feeling.
The fire
yes.
in the belly?
Yes. And in Lansing, I think they had more of a rural workforce – and Lansing was on the verge of losing its two auto plants, and they were able to convince GM to stay in town. And the mayor at the time, David Hollister, he credited the work attitudes of the Lansing auto workers as a reason that GM stayed. So I think nobody should come out and blame unions for the problems or for factories or industry going down. There's a right way to do it and there's a wrong way to do it. Mm. There's a cooperative way to do it and there's an antagonistic way to do it.
Now, the book is The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. So, Ted, if we look ahead to the future, what did you find in your reporting that gave you some hope of new directions for Rust Belt cities?
Well, I found some cities doing things with high technology and alternative energy, using some of the land and some of the skills that were left over from industry in Buffalo. The picture on the cover is in Lackawanna, New York, mm-hmm. and that's the old Bethlehem Steel plant, and that's the site of the First Winds wind farm, and that's capturing the wind off Lake Erie. And then you might see that on a lot of Buffalo Bills games because that's sort of become a symbol of Buffalo. Another place I went to, I went to a place in Lansing where they're making cyclotrons. Atom smashers, and they're using the skills of a lot of the guys who work there are retired auto workers. And he said, there's no other place I could do this because there's no other place that has a combination of the academic knowledge at the university and the skilled labor. They just don't value that, say, in Massachusetts or New York City. There aren't the people who can actually make these things.
What about, I know you get into Detroit, you talk about urban agriculture. Does that give you any hope for something really solid to build a foundation on?
Well, it's not the ideal use for a city. Mm-hmm. I mean, the purpose of a city is to trade goods to the countryside for food.
Yeah.
But Detroit is a food desert. I mean, there is a dearth of fresh food in Detroit. I had trouble buying fruit after 9 p.m.
It was a big deal that the Whole Foods just opened in Midtown.
That's terrific, but not going to reach a lot of the neighborhoods it needs to reach.
And does one worry that as you see the young and hip and predominantly white residents maybe moving into areas in Detroit and getting more attention and services than the long-suffering black residents.
Well, see, they worry about it. I heard that from a couple people. They said,
are there going to be two Detroits?
Well, they said they're coming back to take it over, and we've been suffering through Detroit for 40 years, and you're used to hearing the suburbanites resisting regionalization, but some of the Detroiters do too because they're afraid they're going to lose power. They're afraid the whites are going to move back in and take what they abandoned and left as a ruin. And I would certainly like to see more regionalism in Detroit, as we're hearing talk of them selling their art collection. That's a treasure that belongs to the whole region. And I think Miami, Indianapolis, Toronto, they all amalgamated, and everybody says, well, it's just politically impossible in Detroit. There's too much antagonism. But I don't know. That doesn't seem like a good excuse to me.
Why did you choose the title Nothing But Blue Skies?
Well, I heard a quote from a man in South Chicago, neighborhood of Illinois. He had grown up outside the U.S. steel plant. He said, I looked up one day and saw a blue sky, and I thought the world had ended because this was after the plant shut down. Mm-hmm. I mean, they used to say if there's soot on the windowsills, there's bread on the table. But it's also a sense of it's a clean slate. Yeah. You can do something different. And in places like Youngstown, Ohio, they say, well, we're never going to be an industrial powerhouse, but we're going to be the best city of 70,000 we can be. And there are a lot of people in Detroit who have that freedom. I mean, you can if you want to do something new, you can have a bigger impact in Detroit than you can have in Chicago or New York or Los Angeles.
Hit that reset button. Edward McClellan's new book explores just what happened to the industrial midsection of America. It is called Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. And it's just published by Bloomsbury Press. It is a good read. I just really got a lot out of it. A great history lesson.
Thank you very much.
up, we'll spend the rest of the program focusing on searching and finding. Why we still give a hoot about possibly finding Labor leader Jimmy Hoffa to actually finding a long-lost message in a bottle. Those stories are next. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, here we go again. The backhoe has been working away in a Michigan field, surrounded by news trucks, satellite trucks, helicopters, police, and the breathless attention of reporters, local, national, even foreign. Yes, it is yet another search for the remains of Jimmy Hoffa. Federal agents revived the hunt for the remains of the Teamster president this week, bringing heavy excavation equipment to a field in Oakland Township, north of Detroit. This time, the tip comes from an aging, reputed mafia captain. Mr. Hoffa was supposed to meet with a New Jersey Teamsters boss and a Detroit mafia boss when he vanished in the summer of 1975 from a Detroit-area restaurant. So 38 years onward, why does anyone still care about where Jimmy Hoffa's body is buried? Joining us is Michigan Radio's political analyst, Jack Lessenberry. We should also say our resident historian. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Cindy. How are you?
I'm great. Jack, is this not a case of much ado about nothing again?
Well, I think it's become kind of a cultural touchstone. It's sort of a summer ritual in Michigan that it's happening a little earlier this summer. Usually it's about August, and sometimes some convict wants a day out of jail, so he claims Hoffa is under somebody's backyard, and they take him out and dig it up and put him back in. But it's become almost a ritual, and sort of a ritual without meaning, much meaning at any rate at this stage.
Well, I'm noticing friends all over Facebook are virtually apoplectic at the idea that this is happening again. One friend comments, step up. Is anyone there taking this dig seriously? And please step up, especially those of you spending my Oakland County, state of Michigan, and federal tax dollars. Take your bows, boys, and tell us what a wonderful idea this is. I think that's a pretty valid view, don't you?
Well, sure. I think absolutely. First of all, let's say they found Jimmy Hoffa's skeleton. What would that prove? I mean, everybody knows he's dead. If he was alive, he'd be, I think, 105. So there's not much chance of that. And there is really no real mystery about what happened to him. But sort of the search goes on, and it's something people seem to be interested in just because it's sort of a happening. There are a couple 22-year-olds who said they canceled their plans to go to the beach, bad mistake, to be near the dig so they could say they were there when they found Jimmy Hoffa, although I don't think too many people really think they're going to find him.
Well, it is expensive. Why, apart from the public curiosity of it and that buzz factor of saying, gee, I was there when they were digging for Jimmy Hoffa, why would, do you think, the federal agents spend the resources and money all these years later when you, as you say, there's no doubt what happened to him?
Well, let me tell you a story about that. Many years ago, back in the 1970s, I knew both quite well Vince Bersani, who was the head of the state's organized crime task force at the time, and Attorney General Frank Kelly. And they had one of these tips, and they had a similar site, and they went out there. And they found out, for various reasons, that the tip was phony. However, the Attorney General said to, and the organized crime man told the Attorney General said, Vince, I believe you, but look, you got all the TV cameras here, you got the TV helicopters here. Vince, dig a hole. And to some extent, it's for the media, and to some extent, it is true that it is an open crime, and it's never been solved, and people talk about having some kind of closure. But in fact, if you're interested, I'm relatively convinced that I know what happened to Jimmy Hoffa.
I am interested. What do you think?
Well, Vince Bersani, who knew Jimmy Hoffa personally, who was Italian himself, had many ties with all these mafia leaders, told me many years ago that what happened was Hoffa was supposed to be warned but not killed, but things got out of hand, and he ended up being killed. And the people who were from New Jersey, who were sent to do it, called the organization. Their code word was oops. They said, we did an oops. And they said, oh, damn it, leave him there. And the mafia, and we know this to be true, had ties with a rendering plant. Rendering plant is where they take animals and boil them down to make things like Crisco in Wayne.
Yeah.
And they took Hoffa's body there within a day. And if you have any cans of 1975 Crisco, I would advise strongly against using them.
Thank you.
And that story made more sense to me than anything else. For one thing, what you would want to do in a case like this is get rid of the body, get rid of the evidence, and you would not want to be carting Hoffa's body all over the place, especially after the first 24 hours and the big police dragnet was on.
Yeah.
So that story makes sense to me. But even if that's wrong, even if he's buried somewhere, I don't know. I don't think we're going to find him holding a piece of paper that said, Michael Corleone killed me.
There you go. Now, I did wonder your thoughts on who the latest tipster is, and that, of course, is Anthony Zarelli, who had, you know, very close ties to reputed figures, even back in that era. Do you feel that he might be more plugged in than some of these other folks that have stepped forward?
Well, he certainly is a higher place source. He certainly was involved, and he knew these people at the time, and certainly that has to give it more credibility than some guy who's in Jackson for a B&E. So he may well have been a position to know, and his details of the story, in some ways, you know, that sounds sort of plausible, but according to him, they whacked him on the head with a shovel, didn't kill him, and buried him alive. And the trouble I have, Cindy, with all conspiracy theories, is that we are a nation of blabbermouths. The minute we commit a crime, we're on the phone to Oprah wanting to go on her show to talk about it. And all these conspiracies, now the mafia are people who can keep their mouth shut, because if they don't keep their mouth shut, they sleep with the fishes.
Yes.
But if people had known about this, a substantial number of people knew about this for any length of time, it's very hard for me to believe they'd keep it secret for 38 years.
Interesting. In meantime, as another wag on Facebook commented, that they felt that Jimmy Hoffa and Jim Morrison and Elvis are all up there having a good chuckle at all of this.
It could be, or it could be that Jimmy Hoffa is in a cave. But it's worth noting, too, that the average age, the median age of people in Michigan is something a little over 39.
Right.
This happened 38 years ago, so the vast majority of people have no conscious memory of Jimmy Hoffa. For older people, I mean, he was sort of the paradigm of a talented but corrupt labor leader in the Teamsters of my youth. He was seen sort of as a god. He was the person who negotiated the master trade agreement that got Teamsters into the middle class. But of course, as we all know, he was thoroughly corrupt. But most people have no conscious memory of him. I would guess if Michigan Radio went out to these people who are surrounding the dig and said, "What do you know about Jimmy Hoffa?" it would be not very much.
Jack Lesenberry, do you think this is at all about achieving any closure for the family, or is it more about bumping up TV news ratings?
Years ago, I knew to some extent Hoffa's son, James Hoffa, who now is the head of the Teamsters, and he indicated to me, it was sort of a delicate topic, but he indicated the family sort of had closure. They knew in their own hearts what had happened to him, and I think they're not very, you know, if they found a body, I'm sure there would be some kind of a burial. But I think these folks have had closure in their minds. There really is only Hoffa's son and his daughter, who is a retired judge in Missouri. His wife is long since deceased. You know, I can't speak for them, but I think in their own minds, they've put this past them a long time ago.
Jack Lesenberry, always a pleasure to talk with you.
My pleasure.
Jack Lesenberry is Michigan Radio's political analyst. Okay, let's take a look at a little more searching, this time with our sense of hearing. Donna Poussant is director of the group Opportunities Unlimited for the Blind. And in one of her projects, dubbed Michigan Bird Brains, Donna's helping blind children and adults connect with nature. Donna joins us now. Explain how this works.
What I've been doing for the last 3 years is meeting monthly with a group at the University of Michigan Dearborn Environmental Interpretive Center. And we are in the classroom for an hour, listening to sounds and comparing one bird's sound or call to another. And then the last hour of the class, we spend traveling the trails out in the natural area at the university, listening for birds that we've learned to identify in the classroom. Now, we also go on a lot of field trips. We've done owl prowls and the hawk fest, and we've specialized in identifying, you know, different groups of birds.
How does that benefit these blind adults and children in a broader way?
Well, just recently I've come to say it's not about the birds. It's about getting blind and visually impaired people outside where they can relate to nature, where they can find some point of contact, in this case being the birds that they're listening for, to identify. And then I kind of use all kind of clues about the environment to help them understand what kind of bird it is. For example, If we're down by the lake, they might be hearing a belted kingfisher. If we're off in the woods, they might be hearing a tufted titmouse. Like, they wouldn't hear the same kind of birds in different environments, and they don't realize right off the bat that they're learning about habitat and ecology and how it all works together in the environment. They end up knowing that, and once they know about it, they care about it, and they want to do what they can to help preserve this wonderful environment that we have.
It also strikes me that as you describe camp experiences, trips to the Upper Peninsula, that has to help build confidence, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's the other side of the coin. When we go outside and travel the trails and identify the birds by hearing them, we're not having a classroom orientation and mobility lesson, but nevertheless, we're walking the trails. We're understanding where you put your cane to feel the edge of the trail and things like that. So it's not a class, per se, on orientation and mobility, but they certainly gain those skills. They also gain personal confidence as they're able to learn and identify the different bird species by their songs and calls. This transfers to let them know blindness doesn't have to be a barrier in their lives for them to become good at many, many, many things and to follow their dreams and be whatever kind of professional, a parent, a teacher. They can grow up and do whatever they want.
And I'm sure that that's reinforced in the camp experiences that you'll be offering this summer. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, we have a couple kind of situations. We have residential camp here at what we call Camp Tuscmahita, which was originally named for the four senses we use besides sight, touch, smell, hearing, and taste. And we have developed a survival art camp, which we're going to be in the Traverse City area camping. And we're combining this survival camping experience with learning about the art that is available in this part of the state. And for us, that will look like not drawing and painting and looking at pictures per se, but finding things like sculpture and particularly maybe Native American ways of doing art. And, of course, we'll be finding some Petoskey stones. And the last week of camping here, we'll be doing something called Making Sense of Our Senses, where we're trying something new this year, and we are inviting sighted children to come and participate with blind children, and we're trying to get the ratio about half and half where we can come together and understand one another and how we do things by using our different senses.
Donna Passant from Opportunities Unlimited for the Blind. Thanks for talking with us.
Sure.
And finally this hour, let's turn from searching to actually discovering a surprise find at the bottom of a river. It was 97 years ago when a couple of young Detroit women were having fun one summer's day at Tajmu. It was a very popular amusement park on Harsons Island, right there on the northern end of Lake St. Clair. After their date, they wrote a message. They rolled it up, tucked it into a bottle, and tossed it in the water. We know all of this because my next guest found that very bottle as he was diving in the St. Clair River. Dave Leander joins us now from his Great Lakes Dive Center in Macomb County. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Cynthia. How are you?
Great. So is that the first time you ever found one? I mean, it's such a cliche, but there it is.
Yeah, first note in a bottle. I mean, the bottles are down there, but this was definitely the first note.
Was it something you could clearly see that there was something besides just one of the many empty bottles that you probably see down there?
There was a rolled up, like receipt paper. It was a little bit thicker than regular paper, and I could definitely see writing. It wasn't legible until I came up out of the water, but I could definitely see writing on there. It was completely an airspace with a cork in it. And as I brought it up, the pressure inside the bottle popped the cork out a little bit, and the note got a little moist, but I dried it off real fast with the heater of my vehicle.
And then what?
I read it. It was written by two girls, and they put their name and their address. Both of them were from Detroit, and they said they dated it. It was dated June 30th, 1915. And they said they were having a great time at Tajmu. And Tajmu was a park very similar to today's Cedar Point, where everybody goes down to Cedar Point. There was a big arcade there in hotels that you could go spend a day or spend a weekend.
And what have you done to preserve this message that lay at the bottom of the St. Clair River for all these years?
Well, I put a better cork in it. I made sure that we fitted a cork so that there would be no more moisture going inside. And we just kind of leave it out of the sun. You don't want to leave it in the sunlight. It was written in pencil, and I think that's what really saved the note, because if it was in ink, I think it would have blurred or run or whatever.
Now, the message was written by Selena Pramsdeller and Tilly Esper. And now that you've had time to look at the note and think about that, how does it make you feel to be the first person to share the words those girls wrote nearly 97 years to the day?
Oh, it's been interesting. Another diver friend of mine, Mike Brodzik, is a bottle collector, so we always compare our finds whenever we bring him up, and he's just an encyclopedia on bottles. And I showed him the note, and he had interest in it, and he took a couple pictures. And his brother and his brother's wife do genealogy, and what they did is they went back and they found, like through Census Bureau and IRS information, who these girls were and where they lived and a little bit about them.
Have you been able to find any relatives?
There's a gentleman, his name's, I forget Bernard's last name, Bernard Licata from the museum on Harson's Island. And he's trying to get a hold of some descendants of these two girls and have them out to the Tajmu days that they're having this July. And he's had phone calls from a couple descendants already. In fact, one grandson that said, hey, that was my grandmother.
Wow.
Well, that's kind of cool. We think it's kind of neat.
Well, so do we. It got me wondering, and I wonder what your thoughts are, Dave. What does it say to you about the permanence of putting something down on paper versus the tweets and emails and Facebook statuses we're doing today?
I'm not a tweeter. I do some Facebook, but not a lot, and it just drives me crazy. But I have in the past, and I'm sure people of my age have put notes in bottles and thrown it overboard and just wonder where it shows up.
And there you found out. Had it actually traveled very far in its 97 years?
I don't believe so. I believe it sunk within a few feet of where it went into the water. It was a heavy glass bottle because the glass at that time of century was a little bit more thicker than it is today. And it was a smaller bottle, and I believe it sunk pretty fast.
How does this rank among all the things you've found at the bottom of lakes and rivers all the years you've been diving?
It's gotten the most attention. The thing that got the most praise was a set of pearls I found one time that my wife dutifully took possession of.
I'm sure she did. Dave Leander is a diver and owner of the Great Lakes Dive Center. He spoke to us from the shop in Shelby Township in Macomb County. Thanks so much, Dave.
Cynthia, thank you very much.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today is Tony Brown and Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Theory, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow at 3:00.